Our last case of the day, In Re Energy Future Holdings Corp. Ms. Kelleher?
That's correct. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Leslie Kelleher of Kaplan & Drysdale, appearing for the appellants. With the Court's permission, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. Your Honors, this appeal concerns claims against four of the debtors, the asbestos debtors. They're separate corporate entities from their parent, EFH, and they have separate bankruptcy cases. Those cases were never substantively consolidated. The bankruptcy court's order discharging unmanifested asbestos claims against these four debtors was unprecedented. We're aware of no other case in which a court discharged unmanifested claims in circumstances like these where the debtors had had prior asbestos liabilities and anticipated future asbestos liabilities. And that discharge violates due process. That violation cannot be remedied by the kind of post-deprivation proceeding that the bankruptcy court suggested.
Are you saying that categorically there can't be any post-deprivation process that would satisfy due process?
Well, one post-deprivation process that clearly satisfied due process is this appeal itself. And under these circumstances, it's very difficult to imagine another kind of proceeding that would satisfy due process. What I would suggest is that the one that would satisfy due process is a prompt hearing on the merits of the claim, and that would really take place in non-bankruptcy court. If I can take it through, in the cases that...
If you wouldn't mind, counsel, stepping back a second. The promptness of the appeal is sort of the issue, right? Because given the procedural posture in which this arose, there was an opportunity to seek a stay and to come forward. So walk us through why that isn't the key issue here.
I'm sorry, if your question went to the promptness of the appeal.
Why wasn't a stay sought?
When the EFH, the merger of EFH with a Sempra subsidiary was noticed and ultimately was approved, that was the merger was a merger of EFH only. It was a sale in that sense of the EFH stock. These debtors, the four asbestos debtors, are separate entities from their corporate parent. They have separate bankruptcy cases, and the sale of EFH stock, as a matter of fundamental corporate law, was not a sale of the stock of the asbestos debtors. It was the purchase of a corporate entity is not the purchase of its assets. Nothing in the notice of the merger or in the proposed order or indeed in the merger agreement itself said that the merger would affect the interests that are at issue here, would affect the claims of unmanifested claimants. And in fact, under Section 363 of the Code, the merger could not be free and clear of those claims. The merger could not somehow discharge those claims, and debtors have not disputed that. A sale of property under 363 may be free and clear of, expunge only claims against the property that's being sold, only interests in the property that's being sold. Here, these claims are not interests in EFH stock. And therefore, it's no surprise that the merger did not claim to be free and clear of these interests, and the merger did not, the notice of the merger did not highlight any assertion that it was free and clear of such claims. So there was no need, frankly, to seek a stay of the merger because it didn't affect these claims. These claims...
The confirmation order says it's authorized the merger. It has a non-severability clause, and they make reference to each other. Why under Sinicola and in the Fifth Circuit's approach to that in Sneed, why aren't these sufficiently intertwined that we view the confirmation order itself as an authorization of sale?
Well, in Sinicola, it was a different situation. It was a situation in which there had been a 363 authorization of the sale of assets, including certain executory contracts, and those, and there was a two orders. The second one was a approval of the assignment of certain executory contracts pursuant to 365. This court recognized that those executory contracts were property of the estate within the meaning of 363, and that the two orders were intertwined, and that the assignment of the executory contracts was also a sale pursuant to 363. Here, whether or not the authorization of the merger of EFH with a Sempra subsidiary is intertwined with the confirmation of the plan as it pertains to EFH, it is not intertwined with the confirmation of the plan as it pertains to the asbestos debtors, and specifically with the discharge of these claims against them. The non-severability provision in the confirmation order cannot deprive the district court or this court, an Article III court, of the jurisdiction to determine whether or not due process was afforded. If these kinds of provisions are found virtually in every plan, in every confirmation order, and this court in ICL Holdings and the Second Circuit and Charter Communications has indicated that we can't allow these non-severability provisions to preclude and to moot out every appeal that could possibly be had. That was in the context
of
that.
I think you've gotten to the answer then. This is, you're viewing this as within what we would characterize as the safety valve to the statute 363M, right? You're not arguing that a stay wasn't required. You're saying it would have been required but for the exceptions that we found in cases like ICO.
Not precisely. We are arguing indeed that this the relief that we're seeking would not affect the validity of the sale and therefore is within that safety valve. But even stepping back, 363M applies only to an appeal of an authorization of a sale. And because this sale did not itself expunge the claims against the asbestos debtors, this is not an appeal of the authorization of the sale. Furthermore, as Your Honor just suggested, we are saying that even if it did, the relief that we're requesting does not affect the validity of the sale because these claims are not claims against EFH stock. The amount that EFH owes to the asbestos debtors are not affected regardless of how much these claims are reinstated. And as a matter of law, it's not an integral term of the merger that these claims be discharged, because if it's an invalid, violates due process to discharge the claims, the debtors and Sempra can't rely on such a provision. As a matter of law, this court will not enforce an unconstitutional provision of an agreement. And furthermore,
that's assuming that a post-deprivation process would not be sufficient.
That's correct. If this court were to find that some kind of post-deprivation process was sufficient, that could be a different story. But I would, if I may address that point, it would be very difficult to imagine what the post-deprivation process would be. There's a long line of cases in the Supreme Court dealing with situations in which property is taken away without notice and what kinds of procedural protections would have to be available. There's no case that says that a post-deprivation process can be substituted for notice. I mean, if that were the case, then prejudgment seizures would be the norm, and they are not. They are only permitted under very limited circumstances. And it's a factor analysis. It's not just a question of having a post-deprivation process. Typically, you have to have some reason for the seizure to begin with, some kind of exigent circumstances. An example that I often use is somebody's got a Monet, they're in a divorce proceeding, and the concern is that one or the other party will destroy it. But other than that, there are other factors, and one of the factors that's very important in this case is the court must assess whether there are other procedural protections that were available or could have been put in place, the value of those protections and the government's interest in providing them or not providing them. In cases involving unmanifested claims in bankruptcy, courts have recognized, including, for example, Judge Weinstein in the Johns Manville case, that the kinds of procedural protections that must be put in place to protect unmanifested claimants who cannot be provided notice are, at the very least, the provision of an unconflicted representative who can protect their rights in negotiations, et cetera, throughout the bankruptcy, and procedures established to ensure that their claims are compensated in an equitable manner. And then in 524G, Congress also recognized that those kinds of protections are necessary.
But it did, 524G is not set up as the exclusive remedy.
This court need not decide whether 524G is an exclusive remedy. Indeed, if a debtor does not want to treat the claims, does not want to impair them in any way and simply reinstate them, the need for a 524G plan is there is no need for a 524G plan.
And Congress set that up with a recognition that notice would be problematic.
Right? That is correct.
For unmanifested claimants. So what difference would it have made to have a representative? Why are we revisiting that process?
Well,
if what you would end up with is some sort of fund available, if it's going to be, you know, under 524G, that's one option, with the process for submitting claims there with whatever proof is required, or a post-deprivation process that is effectively the same thing with the escrow account that has been represented to have the $100 million that is supposedly more than sufficient for the estimated claims.
If I may unpack that a little bit, because there's a couple of points in there. One is that it's not an escrow account. It is the assets of the asbestos debtors amount to some $860 million, and according to the debtors' valuation of the asbestos claims, it would be enough to pay all of them many times over if they were not discharged. However, under this plan, many unmanifested asbestos claims under the confirmation order have indeed been discharged, and so they wouldn't have access to those funds. With a 524G plan, no future claims are discharged in that sense. They are simply channeled to a trust, and the trust has must have mechanisms employed to ensure that future claims are paid in an equitable manner to current claims. And you asked, though, a question. I'm sorry.
Just so I understand clearly, you're saying that the funds that were set aside for asbestos liability would not be available for unmanifested claimants who come forward in the future and satisfy whatever process was put into place by the bankruptcy court?
They would only be available if, in this collateral attack, the court determined that these claims could be forwarded. Go forward. I'd like to address, if I may, why that doesn't satisfy due process. As I've mentioned, there's certainly no case that holds that you can simply substitute a post-deprivation hearing for notice. And here, it would be particularly unsatisfactory because if a certain claimant's due process rights were violated because the notice was not sufficient, the bankruptcy court had already determined that the notice was sufficient. So there's a couple of options. It's not clear what the court envisioned. The debtors have suggested it would be a motion to file a late claim, but it is clear that a motion to file a late claim would not address the due process issue. In this court's decision in Chemitron, the court addressed first whether or not notice had been provided and only went to the question of filing a late claim when it determined notice was constitutionally adequate.
Again, though, why are we talking about notice as the relevant comparison to the post-deprivation process? Isn't the relevant comparison whatever pre-deprivation process would have been provided, that is, the application for funds from a 524G trust, or the post-deprivation process of whatever claims process was in place for access to the escrow account or whatever funds were available set aside specifically for asbestos liability?
If you go through 524G, if a debtor proposes a 524G, the procedural protections that are provided in 524G are there for to ensure that due process has been provided to unmanifested claimants. So those provisions are in place during confirmation, as this court recognized in combustion engineering, having a futures representative there to negotiate and protect their rights, and having a fund set up and some other procedural protections will satisfy due process. That didn't occur here. And so, you know, the 524G procedural protections are in place pre-confirmation. The fund is available for post-confirmation, but it's not, we're not comparing apples to apples there.
What process would need to be provided post-deprivation?
I'm sorry, I'm out of time.
As you probably recognized, having sat through some arguments, we will be liberal with our time here.
Thank you, Your Honors. As I said, it's very difficult to imagine how a post-deprivation hearing of some sort could remedy the due process violation. For example, if it were a motion to file a late claim, that's a balancing of the equities, and the determination of due process wouldn't be made there. And so if it's a due process determination, then the claim, you don't have to go into that. Another option would be, for example, you could go to state court and be dragged into the bankruptcy court on contempt. That's not particularly attractive. It may be that what the bankruptcy court envisioned would be that an individual claimant would return to the bankruptcy court and say, I believe that this violated my due process rights, and the court would then seek a declaratory judgment, and the court would address that. But that's going in front of the court that has already determined that the notice program was facially constitutional, and it's clear what I would imagine it's clear what the result would be there, and it would have to be appealed to the district court and then back to this court. And during that period of time, when the person who has just discovered that they have mesothelioma would like to pursue their tort claim in a non-bankruptcy court, they'll be tied up in the bankruptcy court and through appeals. And during that time, their claims will decrease in value. They will some will be lost if the injured party dies during the pendency of that action. In many states, their claims for pain and suffering are no longer viable. They also have to, it's very difficult for them to proceed with claims against other parties, which is typical in asbestos cases.
So, Kessler, you're describing, as you see it, a cumbersome, complicated, and arduous process for people seeking to make claims. That sounds like it's central to the organization of the plan. It sounds like it's not so divorced from the plan that was approved, but it sounds like it was one of the considerations on which the debtors relied. So why doesn't that move us right back into what we've said in cases like Pursuit, to say that's why you have to seek a stay before confirmation, because it avoids what you're speculating will happen, which is basically an unwinding of this whole process so that we can accommodate the concerns you're raising. Why doesn't this put us right back into the stay problem?
Well, with respect, as a matter of law and of fact, the discharge of these claims was not a consideration on which Sempra relied. When Sempra entered into, when the plan was confirmed, Sempra was aware that the bankruptcy court had already said that in some unspecified manner, it may be that these claimants had not been provided due process, and in some unspecified manner they could collaterally attack the order and all of them would be reinstated. And in fact, the counsel for the debtors provided Sempra with the debtors' analysis of how much those claims would be valued, an aggregate valuation of those claims, in order to ensure that Sempra knew what it was looking at if, in fact, due process had not been provided. And as a sophisticated investor, Sempra would have taken that into account in valuing these claims. Also, I would like to point out that the confirmation order is a 180-page order. The question in Pursuit is whether the relief that's requested would somehow invalidate the sale, whether the in the context of the merger, Sempra was relying on the discharge of these claims. And as I said, as a matter of law, it could not because it can't rely on an unconstitutional discharge. And as a matter of fact, as I've just gone through, it did not because it knew that these claims might not be discharged. At the most, you could say that this would be a collateral attack on the merger order, but 363M does not preclude collateral attacks on authorizations.
Counsel, again, all of this, it seems to beg the question whether a post-deprivation process would deny due process. You seem to be describing a post-deprivation process where an individual litigant would need to come forward and seek a declaratory judgment about whether due process was provided by the original discharge or the terms of the original plan. But as I understood what the bankruptcy court said, it was anticipating, yes, it would be discharged, but individual litigants could come forward in a process that would not necessarily be cumbersome, in fact, perhaps could mirror the process at the outset, and with a showing of as to them as was termed as applied, could satisfy the factors identified in Grossman's and have access to the funds based on the claim that they submitted. Why would that deny due process? And isn't that exactly what was considered as a provision of the sale? If that's what's at issue, in other words, aren't we out of the realm entirely of being concerned about whether we need to rely on the safety valve or 363M? This wouldn't affect the validity of the sale. The post-deprivation process was actually a provision of the sale.
The post-deprivation, this contemplation of a post-deprivation process wasn't in the merger agreement. The merger agreement simply says that legacy claims will be the responsibility of the Eastside debtors. It had a reference to the plan. It didn't say that it's a condition of the merger that these claims initially be discharged and then this post-deprivation process be put in place rather than allowing an appeal. It simply said that the plan had to be acceptable to Sempra. But I think that, if I may, just address again this issue of why this kind of process is not sufficient to remedy the due process deprivation, the due process violation, because at the moment that the claims are discharged, the ability of some future tort claimant or the unmanifested appellants here who have claims, Mr. Berkschneider cannot now proceed with his claim in a non-bankruptcy court. He has been deprived of that claim right now. And even if in a couple of years down the line there's a determination after he's gone through this, whatever this process would be, there's a determination that indeed he should be able to proceed with the claim, that temporary deprivation has not been remedied. And that is the kind of issue that the Supreme Court discusses in cases like North Georgia Finishing versus DICAM, where a bank account is garnished and the court says, the absence of the ability to go right to court and decide whether or not that garnishment should have taken place, whether there was any kind of on the merits, decide on the merits of the case, whether there was a right to go after this money, whether there was this money was owed, is highly problematic that you don't have that in place.
In part, we don't have that here because rather than going to the bankruptcy court and testing what that process would be, instead the claimants have come to us, which is their right. But as a result, we're in the position of trying to envision what that process might look like, as opposed to knowing what the bankruptcy court was going to plan to put in place. Tell us, with the limited time we have, what you think a post-deprivation process would need to look like to satisfy due process.
Well, as I've said, I do not believe it could satisfy due process. I think the protections that you need in place would have been a unconflicted representative for these claimants and a fund. But if I have to imagine what it would be,
what's different about the fund that is available now versus in both cases there are funds set aside that the parties seem to agree is more than sufficient to cover the liability at issue. So isn't this just a matter of what burden is placed on a claimant to make their showing to have access to the fund?
If I just may address, there's not really a guarantee that the funds are available. As a practical matter, of course, if they start to run out of funds, which according to debtors would not happen, but then they could go back into bankruptcy. But there's no guarantee that all claims would be paid equally, that the future claims in 30 years from now would be paid in a manner that's that is sufficiently equitable with current claims in similar situations today. And that is to ensure equitable treatment, which is fundamental in bankruptcy. But to address your other point that all are what we're talking about, just the burden that's placed on the claimants, and that is very much a large part of the problem, is that if claimants have to return to the bankruptcy court, they've got problems with devaluation of their claims, and they have to hire additional counsel to go into bankruptcy court. Many, you know, could be across the country from where their claims are pending in non-bankruptcy court, and having to do those things, having to go through these hoops before they can pursue their claims, is a deprivation of the right to pursue their claim. And it's itself is part of the problem. It does not cure the deprivation of the right to pursue their claims.
How would that be a different process than someone on the other side of the country who wished to submit a claim under a 524G trust?
Under 524G, their claim would not have been discharged. They would not have to demonstrate that somehow the balance of the equities is such that they should be allowed to submit the claim. They simply submit the claim, and it's going. That process is one that deals with the claim on the merits. It is the equivalent of going directly to state court.
But again, you're saying the balance of the equity is, if the showing was didn't receive notice, had exposure, had a claim at the time of the confirmation order, a simple affidavit to that effect, how would that be different in any meaningful way than the pre-deprivation process?
Well, we're not arguing that it had to be 524G or this. What we are arguing, and the court need not decide that, what the court need to decide is whether in the circumstance of this case that the discharge of the claims failed to comport with due process. And you have to look at what procedures were set into place, and the only one, it's been suggested, is some kind of a post-deprivation remedy.
So we have discharge, but we have the bankruptcy court that can retain jurisdiction indefinitely, having said that it would reinstate claims of claimants who can't come before it in the future, having said repeatedly on the record that that's what it anticipated as part and parcel of this sale, of the merger itself, and of EFH's counsel saying the exact same thing, that in effect there would be no denial, no deprivation, because claims would simply be reinstated. Now, what is required for them to be reinstated and whether that comports with due process may require some fleshing out, but what is the difference for due process purposes between a claim that has not been discharged, where you're going and seeking funds, versus a claim that was discharged and can be reinstated with essentially the same nature of claim?
Well, if I may, when one approaches a 524G, a trust established to satisfy 524G, the claim is going to be determined on the merits by the plan, and I'm almost hearing you're envisioning it as this post deprivation hearing, whatever this hearing is going to be, being put into place to substitute for a 524G plan. But if that's what the court is doing, we're into a whole other issue, is whether or not, then I suppose that would be under the court's authority under Bankruptcy Code 105. And in combustion engineering, this court indicated that you could not try to do something akin to 524G pursuant to Section 105. That, so I, you know, if we're getting into that realm, but I don't think that's what this court did, because there was no fund established for these claimants. What happened is that the reason we're talking about a fund, what it is that because the claims, because asbestos claims were passed through the bankruptcy unimpaired to be resolved by the reorganized debtors, the reorganized debtors' assets will be available just like they would have been before the case was filed. There was in this instance there is no fund set aside for these debtors. As a practical matter, when you sue a solvent debtor, you will succeed in your claim, and the debtors assert that they have more than enough money to pay everything. But if they didn't, then there would be no assurance that as what you've got under 524G that all claimants would be treated equitably, and that's part of what is so fundamental, you know, both before 524G was enacted and after. But also, if I may just turn to the point about the futures claimants representative, is that this court and the Supreme Court have been unequivocal in stating that if you're in any kind of a proceeding, bankruptcy or otherwise, in which a unmanifested asbestos claimant's rights may be affected, they must have an unconflicted representative. And in this case, it actually made a big difference, because the unconflicted representative would have negotiated on their behalf, and one of the things it would have done, an impartial representative would have done, would have filed proofs of claim, a class proof of claim, on behalf of all of these claimants. That's what the futures representative said he was going to do in the Bondex case. We referenced it in our brief. And when he did so, that case quickly ended with a 524G consensual plan. All courts that have dealt with these issues have recognized that these claims cannot be simply dispensed with.
But that was sought here, and it was denied by the bankruptcy judge.
I'm sorry.
That was sought here, right?
A 524G plan. At one point early on, there was an argument made, and this was before any plan had been proposed. An argument was made that 524G was mandatory. The judge rejected that. We are not arguing that's mandatory. Absolutely, the court, at that point, it was still open to the debtor to simply reinstate the claims and not discharge them. And at one point, the bankruptcy court also said, you know, I regret that they did this. I'd be happy to be overturned on this issue of saying that did not violate due process.
The proposal of a class representative filing class-wide claims, that was proposed, and that was also rejected by the judge.
That is different from a future claimants representative. Future claimants representative has standing, is appointed by the court and is akin to a committee, and has standing to represent the interests of the claimants whose rights he represents. What happened in this case was that there had been a motion by some other parties to certify a class and file a class action claim there. Because under AmChem and Ortiz, you can't have a class action for asbestos claimants. This is one of the reasons that you have to have a court-appointed representative who's akin to a trustee, you know, akin to the fiduciaries that the Supreme Court discusses in Sprint Communications, you know, akin to a guardian, akin to it's not really clear exactly what that role is, and the courts have grappled with it, but it does give that person who is appointed to represent those rights, gives them unquestionable standing, and gives them the ability to negotiate in the plan, gives them ability to as I said, that, you know, it was never tested, but a future claimants representative, if I'm in there acting akin to a guardian ad litem for some unidentified claimant, I can file a claim on their behalf. That's very different from somebody trying to come in and create a class action in order to do it. That person, the futures representative, is in a very different situation. And I keep saying futures representative because that's the term that's typically used in these cases, but that person represents unmanifested claimants as well, who are exposed pre-petition as well as, you know, anybody in the future.
When you say anybody in the future, that same representative is in place to navigate for future claimants who come forward and to file proofs of claim?
Under 524G, and you know, that's what we're looking at here. You could separate the two, but under 524G, the future claimant's representative that must be appointed will represent persons who have unmanifested claims caused by pre-petition exposure, as well as what would be a very small number, if any, claimants who might be exposed post-petition. That's a very rare situation because these asbestos defendants typically have not used asbestos in the same way because of OSHA regulations, et cetera. You know, these asbestos claims have such a long latency period that even though these exposures took place many decades ago, they will still continue to manifest for decades in the future. And there's no dispute here that that is the case. That is epidemiology that's generally accepted.
And if you're representing, and we'll hear from your adversaries, but that there is no escrow fund, there's no funds that have been specifically earmarked for asbestos liability, but rather it's simply the credit of the reorganized debtor standing behind those liabilities, then short of a future bankruptcy, the ability to pay would not be limited. Is that right?
That is generally correct. Whether the ability to pay is limited depends on the amount that the asbestos debtors have as assets versus claims on those assets. Of course, if the claims were to exceed the assets, the ability to pay would be limited. But according to the debtors, they have $860 million in assets, and the debtors have valued these asbestos claims as at most approximately $51 million. That includes both current and future. Approximately $40 million is for future unmanifested claims. They also have some other claims against them that are, you know, legacy employment benefits related claims. But if in some, you know, universe, the debtors, asbestos debtors, found that their assets were not sufficient, if, for example, EFH ceased paying on the amount that it owes to the asbestos debtors, they could certainly seek 524G and then establish either a fund or you know, contribute their stock to that, and that would be the fund that would be available. And 524G is a complicated creature, and I'm happy to answer any questions about it, but as I said, while 524G plan would certainly have resolved this issue and would have satisfied due process because of the protections it provides, as this court's recognized in combustion engineering. We're not arguing it was mandatory. A debtor can absolutely pass through its claims to the reorganized debtors unimpaired if it would not create a problem of feasibility, if it would not mean that they would immediately be back into bankruptcy. And here the bankruptcy court found there's enough assets available to pay these claims many times over. So that was certainly available to them. What was not available to them to the asbestos debtors is deciding that we're simply going to get rid of these claims and do that based on this notice program. When we're highly solvent, when we know that we've had these asbestos claims for years, when we know that we're going to have them asserted against us for years, when we know that these, from AmChem, that these legions of unself-conscious and amorphous, unmanifested claimants, even if they saw, according to AmChem, the Supreme Court in AmChem, and this court below, even if these claimants saw the notice and understood its significance, because they cannot know, these people exposed cannot know that they'll be among the very small portion of people exposed who ultimately will suffer injury, they don't have the information and foresight that they need to make rational, intelligent decisions about their claim. And for that reason, the court in AmChem concluded, and courts subsequent have concluded, that a notice program directed to claimants in this unmanifested claims, in these kinds of circumstances, simply doesn't satisfy due process because it's not the actions of a debtor who, in the words of the court in Mullane, is truly desirous of affording due process, truly desirous of providing notice. A debtor who really wants to give due process, who really wants to treat its claimants fairly, would not prevent, would not oppose the appointment of an unconflicted representative for these claimants, and would not then use a notice program that the debtor, you know, can predict, and anyone can predict, will result in having the bulk of these claims discharged. A debtor really wanting to provide due process would either simply pass them through or take the road that Congress provided to deal with asbestos claims. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Chris Shore on behalf of the reorganized debtors. As laid out in the order allocating time, I'm going to address the Section 363M issues as the purchaser, which by virtue of the merger became the reorganized debtors, and Mr. McCain will handle the issues with respect to due process and notice in the underlying proceedings. But let me explain the allocation, because so much of the appellant's argument is around the changes to procedures and things that could have been done. The relief they actually requested below, which was the subject of the order on appeal, and the relief they requested here, is that all unmanifested asbestos claimants retain their causes of action against the asbestos debtors. In essence, they asked the district court below, and they asked this court in their opening brief, for a blanket allowance of claims. Regardless of whether a proof of claim was filed, they can pursue their claims against the asbestos debtors. I'll explain that the allowance of those claims without a proof of claim is a change of the terms of the sale transaction. And as the purchaser, I'm going to spend my time focusing on that. Unless the court wants to hear about issues relating to their failure to obtain a stay or the good faith finding of the court, I really want to focus on two issues. The whether we have an authorization of the sale and what constitutes that, and is the validity of the sale at issue here, given the relief requested. And in dealing with those two issues and trying to answer the questions that the panel sent out, I'd like to focus really on two concepts. One is the deal structure, which deals a lot with the questions of wherewithal of payment and the integral nature of these provisions to the sale, and then also deal with the materiality concept that they've raised, that we're just making small changes to a big deal. With respect to the deal structure, included in the appendix is the long disclosure statement, which was approved by the court, which lays out the history of EFH and its subsidiary debtors. And by the time we got to the merger, which included a whole merchant power arm that was sold pursuant to a separate plan of reorganization, which actually came up to the Third Circuit in one form. By the time of the merger agreement, there was just a stack of EFH and EFIH. And the only assets that they had were cash at EFH, cash at EFIH, and the stock in a company called Encore Electric Delivery Company, which is the ultimate parent of Encore Electric Delivery Company, which is a Texas utility. And much of the back and forth that happened in the case was around the transfer of the ownership of that, which required the Public Utilities Commission. And there was a specific marketing of that stock. That was the asset worth $7 to $10 billion that was first sold to NextEra, which it was first sold to a consortium of creditors, then it was sold to NextEra. Both those deals failed the CPUC. It was then sold to Berkshire, and then Sempra came in before the merger approval order and came in. So that was fundamentally the only asset of debtors. The asbestos debtors had no assets. They had no cash. They had no stock in Encore or any other saleable asset. They had intercompany claims, which I'll touch on. Importantly, though, the stock was not sold and was never offered for sale down at the OEDC level. It was only offered as a sale at the EFH level. And it set forth in the disclosure statement at Appendix 1964 to 65 and 1982 and 1983, there's a long description of the tax consequences of doing a taxable disposition of that Encore stock below the ultimate taxpayer EFH, and what was colloquially referred to below as tax Armageddon. Because if there were a taxable transaction, the IRS would have claims at EFH and potentially EFIH, which would dilute down the recoveries of the creditors. At the time, even though they had the few cash assets, EFH had $2 billion of claims. EFIH had $6 billion of claims, all which were sitting between the ultimate parent and the valued stock. The claims were estimated to be in the billions of dollars, and there's a specific risk factor in the plan, that if there was a taxable transaction, that $4 to $6 billion of additional tax liability could hit. That's why we have a structure here where the asset, which is stock down below, is being purchased at the top. And the fundamental question that the debtors have to deal with is, how do I sell valuable stock down below when I want to sell it at the parent entity, which has to be done through a merger to make it a tax-free transaction? And the solution had to be, we have to cordon off and separate out the claims from the consideration. Because Sempra is not going to pay $9.45 billion to buy equity in a company that has $2 billion of debt, which owns another company that has $6 billion of debt with a giant tax liability associated with it. So fundamental to the deal was an allocation of what liabilities Sempra is going to be taking as the ultimate purchaser in connection with the transaction that's going to occur.
Was it or was it not understood that part of the liability it was accepting in connection with the sale was the reinstatement of those future claimants who came forward and made a sufficient showing under Grossman's to seek damages for their manifested injuries?
It is, but one of the terms of that deal was the claims had to be allowed. Fundamentally, when being asked to take on the responsibility of, in order to get the Encore shares, take on the responsibilities of, let me back up. Sempra, of course, would have loved to have closed down below. You buy the stock down at the OEDC level, and you don't have to take on any of these additional liabilities. But what Sempra did agree to take in the terms of the merger order and the confirmation order, and I'm going to come why they are inextricably intertwined, by the terms of that, the only claims which the successor entity, the reorganized debtors, took was responsibility for allowed claims, a very specifically defined term to include timely filed claims against the debtors. And the reason that's a deal term is because as the party coming in from the outside, taking on asbestos liability, you know exactly the number of proofs of claim which have been filed, and you can make an assessment of the likelihood that parties are going to go through a process and come forward and seek to have their claim deemed timely filed based on a showing that they had no actual notice of the proceedings.
But as to unmanifested claimants, it's also apparent from the record that there was allocation made, anticipated, for future claimants who would be able to come forward, with both EFH's counsel and the bankruptcy judge saying repeatedly that they anticipated some unspecified process afterwards for individual claimants to come forward and seek as applied to them their claims.
There's never been a question that Sempra's intention is, if a party comes forward and has their claim allowed, and they therefore fit within Class A3, they get the treatment which is permitted in the plan, which is the reinstatement of their claims.
So that would not affect the validity of the sale. That's what was anticipated as part of the sale.
What was not anticipated as part of the sale is the relief that they've requested, which is that all asbestos claims are deemed allowed regardless of the filing of any proof of claim or the following of any process. That's what's being changed here. The relief requested all unmanifested claimants may recover against the asbestos debtors is not the deal laid out in the plan.
But to be clear, a post-deprivation process allowing for claims to be reinstated is understood to be part of the plan.
It is. It's the part of them. Let me back up. I don't want to steal Mr. McCain's thunder. It's part of every plan. Any party who fails to file a proof of claim in a case is deprived of their property. There is an order, the bar date order, which says you will not get a treatment under the plan, and then the plan says you're not getting a treatment. That's not just unmanifested claimants. That's a contract creditor. That's an employee. And there is a process set up, Rule 3003. You go to the court, which has deprived you of your property, your claim against the debtor, without notice, and you seek for cause to open up the bar date, and courts do that. So there is a process there, and as a purchaser and purchaser of bankrupt assets, you have an understanding of the likelihood that that's going to happen, the frequency that that's going to happen.
And the showing that would be required under Grossman's to satisfy that threshold, that excusable neglect threshold.
Well, depending on whether you're dealing with actual notice or constructive notice, I have a feeling that some people aren't coming forward because they have actual knowledge. We have three appellants here who did have knowledge of the bankruptcy case. They unmanifested claimants who did not file proofs of claim, who have come forward and sought to unwind the transaction. Right, so let me deal with inextricably intertwined, coming out of that concept that what we bought was worthless in the absence of a very defined channeling of claims back and forth. A plan, the question in Sinicola is, did the court contemplate that there would be, the orders would be read together? The merger order specifically, or the merger agreement specifically, contemplates that there's going to be a plan. The last whereas, I'll give you the cite on this, in the merger agreement at A1703 specifically states that the transaction is going to be consummated pursuant to the plan. Section 7.1E of the agreement set out that the debtors have to very clearly delineate in the plan which liabilities were going to be channeled to the cash fund and which liabilities were going to remain with the reorganized debtors. And 7.1A requires a confirmation order to effectuate that central part of the deal. Now, appellants have contended that upon entry of the order, the merger order, the debtors were authorized to close. That's not true. They were only authorized to close if the conditions were met to closing. And as I said, Semper's never going to waive the condition that says claims have to be separated out. And the only way to separate out claims, to take a claim which exists against the debtor and move it to a pool of cash or move it to a reorganized debtor, is through a plan process. Plans allow for the treatment of the claims. And the bankruptcy court, specifically in the merger order at paragraph 4, specifically reserved all plan issues with respect to the merger order. In other words, how it was going to be sorted, what liabilities were going to go where, was specifically preserved for the subsequent confirmation order. So clearly, within the four corners of the merger order, merger approval order, is a contemplation of the further order, the confirmation order, which is the one that's going to ultimately authorize the debtors to close. So, to answer the panel's first written question, the two orders are inextricably intertwined. And that's done in the intertwining comes in paragraph 92 of the order, which very specifically delineates which claims go where, enjoins anybody from seeking to assert claims against the reorganized debtors unless they fit in the specified category. And then plan, Article 7F of the plan says that if the claims aren't allowed, if the claims are allowed, they get reinstated. So that's the specific provision they're trying to change. They're trying to say that the all claims are reinstated. Everybody can proceed regardless of whether they timely filed a proof of claim. And that's answering your question, Judge Mady. That is their going in and trying to open up the terms of the sale to effectuate a different allocation of liability. Again, we only bought liabilities, which is the obverse of the sale price, only bought very specific liabilities. We bought allowed claim liability, not all asbestos claim liability.
But all asbestos claim liability of individuals who come forward even now and make a showing that satisfies a due process deprivation under, presumably under the Grossman factors.
Right, but that goes to some extent to the issue of materiality, which I'm going to address. I'm out of time, but that's a question of, can you make just a small change? What if we just add in a new material or a new immaterial thing? We're just going to make this little change. I don't think the statute, first of all, isn't written that way. The statute says it's a modification. Doesn't say material modification, immaterial modification. It says modification, right, which will affect, not materially affect, not immaterial affect. Once the fundamental premise of pursuit is, once you determine that it is a consideration of the seller or of the purchaser in the transaction, you can't touch that provision. I laid it out. Our determination to take on the liability of asbestos was obviously heavily negotiated, appears throughout the agreement, and it has very specific language about what liability gets reinstated. So their statement that, well, I'm just adding a few more, or you took the risk, no, we can't touch that provision. Now, the fact is that it is a material modification. Allowing parties to come in, whether or not they have filed proofs of claim, is, and we laid out the statements in their briefs, is opening the door to a potential floodgate of problems, and it takes away SEMPRA's ability to understand the scope of the liability. As I said, we can't, and it's maybe said best in the amicus brief, history explains that when parties are faced with this process, they may be less likely to come forward. So we're taking our defined universe and our known universe and opening it up into a wide open universe of claims out in the future, regardless of how the bankruptcy court might dispose of those claims.
But conceivably, those future claims could be all the allowable claims that the counsel is requesting.
They could
change to.
They could all be allowable claims if they came into the court and convinced the court that they had no actual or constructive notice of the bankruptcy proceedings. That is a claim that we agreed to pick up. A lot of what the appellants are doing here, and this is maybe the fundamental purpose behind 363M, is say, I want this, I like all these provisions of the plan. I don't like this one. Right? Let's talk about, and the question was setting up a 524G trust, and why wasn't that done? These asbestos debtors, let's be clear about what the asbestos plaintiff's position was before the bankruptcy case. They had to bring a suit against a asbestos debtor. They had to get a judgment on that. Its obligor, the asbestos debtor, had no assets. Right? It's only no cash, no stock, no property. The only asset it had was an intercompany claim up the chain from the various asbestos debtors into EFH. That's not that you can't establish a 524G trust with an intercompany claim, which, by the way, would have all been subject to a dispute in the bankruptcy case. It would have to be litigated. You'd have to get an intercompany claim deemed to be a valid debt and not a book entry. Right? And without any of that, they would never have had any money, and that at the end of the day, their only recourse on that intercompany claim was into EFH, a company which already had billions of dollars of liability.
But counsel, that could have been set up through SEPA, and presumably still could be set up, right?
But what they're asking is, and again, we left intact their claims, but we also left intact the corporate form. The liability of those debtors is a liability of those debtors. There's no liability that's been asserted against EFH or up to Sempra for any of that. So what they got out of this transaction, though, right, is they have a process by which they get their claim allowed, right? They can then bring a claim against the reorganized debtors, and there will be money from which to fund that. That intercompany claim is not only not disputed now, it's allowed, and it stands between Sempra and its equity.
Where is the assurance that those funds will be available, and where is the disconnect? In the record, it reflects it, Jay, 2789, that there's $130 million that was set aside for asbestos liability. We're hearing from your colleague that there is, in fact, no particular funds earmarked for that liability.
There was a structure under the NextEra merger agreement whereby they were going to set aside distinct funds and cancel all the intercompany claims. Right? That was not pursued in this transaction. But the evidence in the record with respect to those claims is not only in the structure, right? As I was saying, the Sempra's equity in Encore has an intervening claim in it at EFH now. EFH is not paying that intercompany claim, which has been allowed. Sempra's devaluing its Encore asset. So that the structure of the deal deals with that. But then also Judge Sanchi specifically found in the confirmation order at paragraph 57, he made a finding of feasibility, as he was required to do, and that he found that each of the debtors, including the asbestos debtors, quote, will have sufficient funds available to meet their obligations under the plan, including sufficient amounts of cash to reasonably assure a payment of allowed claims. That finding, for further color, was backed up by record evidence, a testimony of the debtor's witness, who was specifically cross-examined by the Asbestos Debtors Council. That's at A2664 and 2665, where he explains what I laid out to you on the structure of the deal and the ability and willingness of Sempra to ensure that those intercompany claims are paid.
Does this dispute between the parties really just boil down to a disagreement about what showing needs to be made for the claims of unmanifested claimants in the future to be allowed?
Well, I don't know what the dispute is. As I said, Rule 3003 of the Bankruptcy Code provides specifically for not just unmanifested claimants, manifested claimants who didn't get notice. It applies to employees who didn't get notice. It applies to everybody.
But this isn't just about whether they received notice or not. Even under Grossman's, it may be that claimants who received notice but had no reason to think it applied to them, for example, or even because they hadn't manifested, didn't have the motivation to move forward, even suspecting that they had been, due process would require that they be allowed.
Right, and that's the concept of cause in Rule 3003. It's delegated to the bankruptcy court to make a determination. It can be based on a whole host of factors that are laid out, and Judge Sanchi very clearly said that he will consider lack of notice to be cause. Now, whether that's lack of notice or lack of appreciation of notice is something that would have to be developed in the bankruptcy court, but at least this court would have something to review as to whether or not the process post-confirmation was appropriate.
Part of the concern with due process is how vague the articulated process is currently, and ascertaining, for example, for a future claimant, where even they would go, which court would be processing such a claim?
If they want reinstatement of their claim, which is the relief they've asked it, they want the ability to sue the asbestos debtors like they never went into bankruptcy, right? They have to get the claim allowed. That's the only liability which the asbestos debtors have picked up and the only liabilities which get treatment under the plan.
So the proper place to retain jurisdiction.
Absolutely retain jurisdiction for the allowance and disallowance of claims, and has a very defined set of rules and case law interpreting the rules with respect to how one goes about getting relief from a bar date. Let me.
Is there a material difference in a future claims representative being available to navigate that process for a claimant in connection with a trust that's been set up versus this post-deprivation process that we're talking about?
Again, when we jump to the 524G issue and setting up a trust, it's all kind of wishful thinking. If we focus, the appellants sometimes want to just focus on, it's just my asbestos debtor, it's just my claims, it's just my issue, and then open it up to, it's the debtor's problem. The EFH never manufactured asbestos, it didn't distribute the asbestos, it didn't do anything else. It bought a subsidiary which had pre-existing old asbestos liability. It maintained the corporate form that was respected in the bankruptcy case. It had no liability for that. These claimants had, as I said, their only recourse to a dollar being paid to these parties was through the assertion of disputed intercompany claims into an insolvent debtor. There was no money, except if one wanted to do it voluntarily, right? There's no money with which to fund a pool. They have been, not only they were not, no rights were taken away from them, right? They have a far superior ability to collect on their claims before the deal was done. That's why I say you can't, right? When you open the 363M is premised on the following. Once we open up a little thing, don't we have to open up everything? If the terms of the deal were, I am willing to pay allowed claims, and if I'm limited to allowed claims, I'll reinstate the intercompany claim. Why isn't it appropriate for us if they open up the door on all claims should be allowed? We shouldn't be able to say, well, then the intercompany claim should be able to be disputed. It's a bigger problem than I thought. I want to maybe cordon off liability that way. And that's why 363M and why the case is just presented a third rail to the notion of once the court determines that there is a provision in the sale order, unstayed, good faith purchaser, that was a consideration of the purchaser, you can't do anything to it. You can't make immaterial modifications. We don't touch it because that's the Pandora's box that gets opened up. That's why the burden is put on parties, especially in a complex case like this, to get up, make your application for a stay pending appeal, address the issue with the court of the necessity for a bond or the size of a bond, and get it addressed then. Because once it's closed, it's very hard to pick it all apart. What do you do, as you pointed out, with the non-severability provision in the plan? That's not something they appealed from. They had the ability to question witnesses about, really, is every part of the plan material? Had they raised that, we could have put on a Semper witness and said, absolutely, I am not taking on claims that are not allowed. I'm only taking on claims that are done pursuant to this process. It's that appellate preservation issue which has to be dealt with at the early stages because you can't unwind it once it's done. And that's what they're asking you to do. They're asking you to unwind the transaction, make a couple of, maybe even just one change. We're just going to cross out allowed claims get reinstated, and it just says claims get reinstated. But that opens up a whole can of worms, which I'd ask you not to do and affirm the district court order.
Good afternoon. Mark McCann of Kirkland & Ellis on behalf of the EFH Plan Administrator Board. Let me go straight to the question, Judge Krause, that you've been asking about this post-deprivation process or the post-confirmation process. This is not inchoate. This goes back, and Mr. Shore referenced this as well. There are federal rules of bankruptcy procedure that provide for this, and Judge Santi made explicit reference to what he was intending in the first, the bar date opinion. There's a bar date opinion and a bar date order, and from the get-go, he specifically said that lack of notice would be cause under 3003C so as to extend the time for a bar date, so as to allow a claimant to file a proof of claim. Then, Your Honors, to the extent that there is further analysis that needs necessary beyond to your point, okay, there was no notice, file your proof of claim. If that is accepted, that becomes an allowed claim under the bankruptcy plan. An allowed claim under the bankruptcy plan under I believe it's class A3, is reinstated against the LSGT debtors. That's what's referred to as the asbestos debtors. In addition to that, and the plan under A12, that's the class of claims that are the intercompany claims between those debtors and the parent, EFH. That reinstates that a means by which that's the funding mechanism that enables those claims to be paid when they are crystallized. So when you're asking what is the post-confirmation process that was envisioned, it is baked into the rules. Judge Santi was very explicit about the notice concern. He recognized, I'm going to do the best I can under Mullane. I'm going to review this plan. By nature, it can't be perfect. And to the extent that someone else manifests down the road, come forward. That's what 3003C allows for. And that was the notice. So when you're asking what additional procedures are, what is the issue, what's the disconnect between us and the appellants, it is far greater than what are the additional steps necessary. They do not want that at all. What they have argued for is essentially that no one who is an unmanifested claimant, and I have to pause for a second because you hear terms a lot, unmanifested claimant versus future claimant. An unmanifested claimant under Grossman's is anyone who is exposed pre-petition who hasn't manifested. A future claimant is someone who may be exposed in the future. These LSGT debtors discontinued operations over 30 years ago. So we're in a situation where the bankruptcy code only allows, even with Grossman's, only allows for claims for pre-petition exposure. So it's all about unmanifested. That's the world we're living in. What they're advocating for is a belief that there is no ability under due process to ever give notice to unmanifested claimants. And you don't have to look farther than their reply brief at page 6. They say that no notice can ever be constitutionally given to that group of people. What they're essentially asking for is an overturning of Grossman's, because they're saying that you could not have a group of people who fall within the definition of claims for which you could give due process. And Grossman's said the opposite. It changed the Frenville rule and then remanded down with direction and guidance to evaluate certain factors. Those are the factors Your Honor has been referring to, one of which is 524G, but not all of them. So it has to be that these claims are dischargeable so long as it is consistent with due process. So the question has always been, if they want something else, the problem is we think they're asking you to implicitly overturn Grossman's. And if they walk it back and say, no, Your Honors, all we're really asking for is specific guidance or specific instructions as to what special notice is needed for unmanifested asbestos claimants, then, Your Honor, they're asking you to create a circuit split, because the Fifth Circuit has addressed that issue in Placid Oil. And in Placid Oil, the Fifth Circuit specifically said, we declined to articulate a new rule that would require more specific notice to unknown potential asbestos claimants. They're not going to create a split. What Fifth Circuit said in Placid Oil was, we're going to allow for the classic noticing program that's been in place and the courts have recognized since Mullane. And then we will do what we consider post hoc. We'll evaluate to the extent someone does not believe they had proper notice in due process. You can come forward on a one-off basis. So when you're asked what is the fundamental disconnect between where the appellants are and where the appellees are, it's we believe the program that was put forward is 100% consistent with Third Circuit law since Grossman's. And what they're asking you to do, it would require a reversal of residence. So, but more importantly, to the extent that you have concerns about a deprivation of due process, it is not inchoate. It's really 3003C. Judge Sanchez was very explicit in that opinion about what the cause would be. And then you could, he could apply the Grossman factor. But ultimately, to the extent that they did not receive notice before, the only question would be, once you became aware of the bankruptcy claim and the need to come here, what have you done? And one of the things I know that they've recognized, that they've read various concerns about, is that a burden to come into the bankruptcy court? Your Honor, in these cases, there have been multiple situations where pro se litigants have come forward and asked to be heard about a proof of claim. You do not need a lawyer to come forward in Judge Sanchez's court and raise a concern about the availability of a proof of claim. And this is a motion. This is not some extended procedure. Rule 3003C, motion to file a late proof of claim, is an established procedure in the bankruptcy code. And to the extent there is a concern about neglect, that is covered under a different rule. That is Federal Rule of Bankruptcy Procedure 9006. So with your honors, with the rules that are in place, and the guidance from the Third Circuit in Grossman's, that Judge Sanchez has everything he needs to evaluate this. And to the questions that Your Honor has raised about like funds and where that money is, the next step in the process is someone to come forward. I manifested. I did not have notice. An affidavit is very common in these type of late file proofs of claim. Judge Sanchez says, ultimately has, you know, concludes, I'm going to make that an allowed claim. Consistent with 3003, I'm not even going to say it's late. I'm extending the timeline as it relates to this individual. That is an allowed claim under the confirmed bankruptcy plan. That allowed claim gets that treatment for reinstatement. That's an A3 claim against the LSGT debtors. And if they come forward with a judgment, you know, they then go off their whatever court they would be filing this in, whether they're in California or New York or wherever, they get a judgment against one of the LSGT debtors. I'm using the terms as they existed in the bankruptcy code, and in bankruptcy at the time, the names may have changed with the ownership from Sempra. What the plan provided for and what Sempra has kept in place is they make that claim that's been crystallized against one of the LSGT debtors. They have interlocking intercompany claims running up to the parent. At the time of the filing of those claims, that was $560 million. Because the debtors advocated for and got a buyer to take these claims and have them reinstated, they got accrued interest throughout the claim of the case. That's why the number went from 560 to over $800 million. And so a claim is made, money is sent down on account of that pre-existing liability, that number is just incrementally reduced, and the funds are paid out. That is what the structure was that was contemplated here. And the reason why this all worked the way it did was the LSGT debtors had directors who evaluated the situation in the first place, and they concluded this was in the best interest of the estates and those involved, their estates. And they evaluated that because these LSGT debtors didn't file for bankruptcy because they had some overwhelming asbestos liability. They filed for bankruptcy because they had no ability to pay claims anymore. And that's because these LSGT debtors, Mr. Schor was right, they didn't have cash. All they had was the intercompany receivables up to EFH. EFH was insolvent. And when it files for bankruptcy, the automatic stay kicks in place. It's almost impossible to get money from a debtor to a non-debtor in that circumstance. There was also the deconsolidation tracks that Mr. Schor referred to earlier. So these LSGT debtors to be part of the global solution. And as the debtors evaluated what to do to how to craft the best solution here, they did engage with the Asbestos Council repeatedly over time. Ultimately, the conclusion was, if we can get a buyer to take these claims, to reinstate these claims, then they would be able to be paid in full over time because the cost of the asbestos liabilities to these debtors in any given year, what was sometimes referred to as the run rate, was approximately $3 million a year. And so the view was, we have to convince a buyer to take these because if we could reinstate the liabilities of the debtors, reinstate the ability to the funds through those claims, that is the best result for all. But candidly, we live in a world where public companies will not take uncapped asbestos liability. And the debtors learned that repeatedly during this process. And so the approach was, then what can we do to convince someone to take this? We need to put forward a bar date. And that was the process and the rationale for why we went down this path. And that's why when the motion was made, we wanted to know on the front end, is this possible? Before we actually put forward a nursing program, this was fully briefed. The people who objected at the time were actually plaintiffs' law firms, who represented a group of claimants. And that was the first decision. That's the bar date opinion that Judge Sanchi issued in 2015, where he evaluated the full panoply of process and due process, all the opportunities that were available, concluded, one, consistent with Grossman's, that unmanifested claims are dischargeable, and that there could be a process, if it was properly constructed, in which you could set a bar date. Because bar dates are required under the Federal Rules of Bankruptcy Procedure. And so consistent with that guidance, he allowed the debtors to go forward. We constructed a notice program. There was a representative for the unsecured creditors at these debtors. That representative was the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors. Two of the five representatives of those creditors were asbestos claimants. They are appellants. Ms. Fahey and...
They were manifested claimants.
They were not.
They were.
They were? Yes. Well, I apologize. They were. So, more importantly, they filed proof of claim. So, Ms. Fennickel and Mr. Fahey were members of the committee. They engaged with the debtors. They originally objected to the notice program. There was a significant back and forth. We had an asbestos notice expert. The committee had an asbestos notice expert. Ultimately, we were able to reach a resolution in which the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors agreed to the noticing program. That's the second bar date order. And it's the first opinion and the second order that collectively address all the due process issues that you're engaging with right now. Is a claim dischargeable, an unmanifested claim dischargeable? And have we satisfied due process with a front-end noticing program and the ability to come back on a one-off basis for people who do not receive notice?
Are those opinions appealable?
They absolutely are appealable. They were not appealed, and that is an issue. So it is our position that those were final orders. And one of the questions that Your Honors asked was with regards to a Ninth Circuit case. In particular, I believe the Frontier decision. And finality in the Third Circuit with regard to bankruptcy decisions is practical. It's not. And one of the things we take issue with the Frontier opinions decision, there were two decisions there. The first one was interlocutory. The courts found it was interlocutory. And so when the appellants only appealed the second decision, it wasn't two standalone opinions. It was one final opinion, one interlocutory opinion. The reason why it was interlocutory is the issue didn't finalize the liability or the damages. Here, if you look at the finality standard in the Third Circuit, there are four factors: the need for further fact-finding, the preclusive effect of the decision on the merits, the impact of on the assets of the estate, and the interest of judicial economy. That's the Owens Cohen decision from 419 F3rd 195. And here, everything that needed to be addressed with regards to are unmanifested claims dischargeable, and does this program with a front-end noticing program and a back-end as applied, does that satisfy due process? That is all contained in those two decisions.
But the fact that it may be appealable as an interlocutory appeal doesn't, we've never said you're required to appeal it. Right. Traditionally, bar orders have not been subjects of even interlocutory appeal.
I think it goes to what was addressed in that opinion in that order. I'm not suggesting all bar date orders should be automatically appealed. What was addressed, the issue that was addressed in that opinion, in that order, are all the issues that are being litigated now. If you look at what's being addressed there, it could have proceeded because there's no further fact-finding that was necessary with regards to the dischargeability issue or the noticing program. The appellate review would have had preclusive effect on those issues on a go-forward basis. It certainly would have impacted the estates if this quarter had concluded that the noticing program was inadequate. The debtors would not have expended over $2.5 million going forward with that program, and would have avoided years and years of litigation that ultimately brought us here today. So, and frankly, what the debtors knew is we needed a bar date to facilitate our ability to identify the claims and put some brackets around them so we could go forward and propose those to a buyer. If we had some concern that we couldn't do that, then the debtors may have to go down a different restructuring path. We've always thought this was the best path because it maximized the ability to get recoveries for asbestos claimants. But that, all of those factors, the finality factors in the Third Circuit, are satisfied. The other issue I know that is brewing is with regards to standing and the one and ripeness. And the one thing, based on the panel's question, the one thing I want to make absolutely clear is Ms. Fennecal and Mr. Fahey, they found proofs of claim. So there's no injury here with regards to them. And I don't think there's an ability for them to stand in the shoes of others with regards to standing. The other three remaining appellants, Mr. Jones, Mr. Heitzman, and Mr. Bergschneider, none of them have taken any efforts in the bankruptcy court to request that Judge Sanchi allow them to file a proof of claim. And we view that as problematic. Because ultimately, we don't think that their claims are right, because they won't know. The idea of has there been a due process concern is still speculative.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you
very much for your arguments. And we'll hear from rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Is there any meaningful relief that the two named Fennecal and Fahey would really be entitled to as a result of this appeal?
That their due process rights were violated by the discharge of their claims, and that their claims, a ruling that their claims are not discharged and that they're retained against the debtors, similar to what this court did in Wright versus Owens Corning.
But they filed their proofs of claim were filed by the bar date.
Oh, I'm sorry. You have to excuse me. You said Fennecal and Fahey. My apologies, Your Honor. I was addressing the unmanifested appellants. With respect to Mr. Fennecal, Ms. Fennecal and Mr. Fahey, they are not seeking relief for themselves. They are seeking relief on behalf of unmanifested appellants. With respect, because it really cannot be questioned, I believe that the unmanifested appellants, Jones, Heitzman, and Bergschneider, do have standing. The court need not even address the standing of Ms. Fennecal and Mr. Fahey.
Okay.
If I just may make a point, a couple of points. One is that the bar date order was interlocutory, and the appellants that are the only ones that the debtors that concede would have standing, concede have been injured, Mr. Jones, Heitzman, and Bergschneider, they weren't even party to the bankruptcy case. They had not manifested their illnesses. They had not been diagnosed at the time of the bankruptcy. The evidence in the record is that they were unaware of the bankruptcy at the time of the bar date. And that is why they joined in the challenge to the discharge of their claims some 2 years later. Throughout these cases, we tried to make challenges to the bar date, we were told, well, the plan can change. It may be that the court will rule that these claims can't be discharged. It may be that whomever becomes the successful bidder will not get these claims discharged. You haven't been injured until your claims have been discharged. To now say that you can't collaterally challenge the bar date is frankly, a bit of sandbagging, and a bar date is an interlocutory order. If I could, unless there's questions on that point, if I could address the point about due process. Placid Oil in the Fifth Circuit is a case very different from this one. All of the cases that the debtors have cited in which courts have held that some small number of unmanifested asbestos claims have been discharged pursuant to a notice program are cases in which the courts have found that the debtors didn't know that there would be these claims out there. And that's an incredibly important distinction. In Amchem, what the court, the Supreme Court and this court below was talking about is that in a situation where, as a matter of epidemiology and statistics, there's an awareness that these claims are going to be accruing and that there's a large number of these claims out there, that you can't give constitutionally adequate notice to such legions of amorphous and unselfconscious claimants. And part of that turns on one of the reasons that it is a due process violation. It goes to what the Supreme Court said in Mullane that I mentioned this, is that it has to be a debtor that's desirous of affording due process. And when the debtor knows all of these things, knows that these claims are going to be out there, that debtor would not simply try to get them discharged. There's a lot more that could be done. You could have a 524G plan. And in fact, if what the debtors wanted was certainty with respect to the amount of the claims, if they truly wanted to cabin the claims, they could do so by adopting a 524G plan, which a earlier successful bidder in these cases, NextEra, advocated, and debtors said no because it would be too expensive and would take too much time. But that is not a reason to dispense with due process.
Due process doesn't require pre-deprivation process. Post-deprivation process under the Supreme Court's case law and our case law is sufficient so long as it can provide meaningful relief judged on a case-by-case basis.
I would submit that there's no rule that a post-deprivation procedure can substitute for notice. Notice is the cornerstone of due process, and the only in limited circumstances can notice be dispensed with. And these cases, I would suggest, are not one of those limited circumstances.
The deprivation is not a deprivation of notice. It's a deprivation of receiving funds on your claim.
The deprivation is a deprivation of the right to pursue the claim. It's a deprivation of the shows in action.
But that has not been extinguished.
By the discharge, it has been extinguished. And what the debtors are urging, perhaps Judge Sanchi contemplated, is that even though that discharge, according to Judge Sanchi, comported with due process, the parties can come back to the bankruptcy court and seek reinstatement of their claim pursuant to Rule 3003, which is not a mechanism for determining the due process issue to begin with. It's quite remarkable, actually, is that what we've got here is debtors asserting that there will be no way for these unmanifested claimants to have the due process argument adjudicated by an Article III court, because the procedure would be this Rule 3003 motion, which the Supreme Court in Pioneer tells us is an excusable neglect, and they can go in and show that they didn't have actual notice. But Amchem tells us that even if unmanifested asbestos claimants receive a notice and understand its significance, they don't know that they're going to fall ill in the future. And by definition, those are the ones whose rights are, they're being deprived of their rights, and they don't have the information they need to determine intelligently what to do, whether to file a claim or not. In this case, the unmanifested appellants that are named appellants did not have notice. They did not receive the notice, and they were not aware of the bankruptcy. But I would submit that even there may have been some that saw it in the paper, and there will have been a lot of unmanifested appellants who didn't know that their loved ones even worked at these places and were exposed to asbestos.
Counsel, we've gone far over. I'll give you a moment to sum up.
With respect to 363F, Well, I will just say with respect to 524G, the debtors could have had a plan, which would have been funded by the stock of the asbestos debtors. We are not challenging the authorization because these claims were not discharged by the 363F sale, and we are not seeking to have Grossman's overturned. Grossman's, like Placid, was a situation in which there was no prior asbestos claims. It was a hardware store, and the court instructed the district court on remand to determine whether due process had been afforded. The court did not instruct the district court to determine whether a late claim could be filed, but to determine whether due process had been afforded. And whether due process is afforded is to be determined under the circumstances. And one of the circumstances the court noted is whether or not you could have had 524G, which was a shorthand for saying, is this a situation where the debtor anticipated a large number of claims? And if they had, I think Grossman suggests that due process would not have been afforded.
Again, on this case, we'd ask that counsel share the cost and order transcripts.
Thank you, Your Honors.